Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have a delicious, well, we'll have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, the most recent five, including this one, pretty much as soon as we get done with it, are archived at the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the most recent five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. So, let's get started. You know, this time our topic is going to be whether or not having a higher education, having a more formal degree, makes you a better, a more competent participant in our, well, whatever we're doing, our mediation, our seminar, our workshop, our community meeting, whatever it is that are getting people together. Whether or not it makes a difference if people are, well, we call them school smart, if people have a more formal, a more traditional education. And you know what, we announced the topics a little ahead of time, and we already had some discussion about it. And, oh, look, we have lots of participation now. Thank you very much for all of your participation. I love hearing from you. Now, oh, Abby's going to start us off, and she's going to say that participants who think they already know the answer don't bother to listen. Yes, she's voting for no, a formal degree doesn't help, because participants who think they already know the answer don't bother to listen. And you know that's kind of true, I suppose. And I'm going to do a disclosure now. one of those disclosures, like you hear people do, and say that yes, I do indeed have two doctorate degrees. I have a JD, and I have an LLM, and it doesn't make me a better participant at all. And the reason that I am able to listen is that I am experienced with mediations, with all kinds of participation, with negotiations, and I have learned to do so. And going to school didn't give that to me, didn't take away from it either. It does perhaps make you able to understand a complex document a little better. But other than that, I'm going to vote, I think. Well, let's talk about it. I won't vote until the very end. Let's talk about whether or not a formal education makes a big difference. Makes a difference. And you know, Abby's voting no. She says that participants who think they already know the answer don't bother to listen. And we've all known people like that, haven't we? Where they come knowing everything, and it's very hard to dissuade them or to reason with them to change their mind. Not impossible, of course. And we have talked about this in prior shows, and I believe I mentioned all the prior shows are archived at the radio station, blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. The last five are archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. And, we have pretty much an even vote either way. Let's see. Hikaru says that higher education is irrelevant, but it's important to know and understand the issues being discussed. Higher education is irrelevant, but it's important to know and understand the issues being discussed. Well, that's a very good point, because really it doesn't make a difference if you've come from a fancy school somewhere, if you've paid no attention to what we're about to talk about, to what is the issues, what is the controversy, what it is that we're trying to resolve, and what the goals are that we are trying to reach. Good point. That the most important thing is to know and understand the issues being discussed. Really, I think it's fair to say that the most important thing is indeed to be prepared, to come prepared, to have thought about it, to have researched it, to have looked at both sides, and to come prepared when you come to a negotiation, a mediation, a seminar, a workshop, whatever it is. Okie dokie. Yes, and Crystal and others, thank you very much for all of your participation. A lot of people are saying basically what Crystal is saying, that it's a question of research and experience so you can give informed opinions. Question of research and experience, not a formal education, so that you can give informed opinions. You can act with authority. You can say something that makes sense. Not because you have sat through 4 years of college, but because you have researched it and you have experience on the topic and you've come prepared. Good point. Mm-hmm. And Najee and others are saying this, not necessarily a specific diploma, but you do need to be able to understand what's going on. You know, that's why I always say, and we always advocate, and I thank you, a lot of you have listened before, and you're saying that's one of my rules, isn't it? There are very few rules, but I think that it is important, and experience really tells me this, that if there's going to be any kind of information given out, like a research paper or a brief, something that is given out that people have to look at and really think about and read, that it be given out before we get together so that everyone has a chance to do what Najee says, that you need to be able to understand what's going on. And it's hard to do that if you don't give out the information first so that we can all read it and think about it and really absorb what's going on and what's going to be discussed. I like to give an agenda before we start, before we get into the room, so that everybody knows what's going to be talked about and they can prepare. I really expect my participants to prepare, to come ready to talk about the issues, ready to have a reasoned opinion, even if it's not the opinion of the majority. You see, everybody has a reasoned opinion when they get there because they've thought about it and they've been given the information, the research, the documents in advance. They've been told where to look for something if it's on the internet, and they've looked and they've considered what it is really that we're talking about and where we wish to go, what the goal is. It's very important. Good point. Thank you very much for your participation. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Megan and others are now, this is a very good point. They're saying that if you have a fairly complex issue, that if you have a text, a document, that understanding will be greater if you have a lot of schooling, a lot of experience with reading complex documents, with reading, somebody's saying fancier words. Well, yeah, with reading and really with considering something that's fairly complicated. Yes, and Najeen and Megan and Gregory and others are saying, thank you for your participation, are saying that if you've got something really complex, if it's multi-issued, and if the documents are hard to read, you might need to call in an expert, somebody who has the schooling, to understand what's going on. And good point. I've got quite a few people telling me that an expert is not necessarily someone with formal training. Very good point. An expert is also someone with a great deal of experience, someone who can say, well, I know what this is. I know how this should be because I have seen it, done it, studied it. There are a whole bunch of different kinds of experts, aren't there? And, yes, I'm going to say the phrase that you all say, I say all the time, but it does. It depends on the issues at hand. It depends how complex they are, how multifaceted. And it is a good point that understanding text will perhaps be easier if you've practiced it with a lot of schooling. Because that's what you do when you go to school, really. You interpret writing, essentially speaking. Mm-hmm. And, Ethan and others are saying that sometimes you need to have someone with technical understanding. And that is indeed where you may need to call in an expert to give an opinion or to find an opinion of an expert concerning the issues. Mm-hmm. Samantha and others are saying that an expert doesn't even need formal education, but doesn't also need experience, just passion. I've got quite a few people voting that they think just passion would lead to a lot of research and understanding and experience, I would hope, because just passion without backing it with anything might just be a personal opinion, and it might not have validity in understanding the issues. I have to think about that one. Yeah, there's not necessarily passion. Yes, passion is important, of course, so that you do the research and you do get the experience and you do think about all sides. But just passion alone, I'm not too sure about as an expert, although it does make an interesting participant. Mm-hmm. Brian and others are saying that they're voting for formal education. Let's talk about voting for it. And they're saying that your self-image is enhanced when you have a higher education, and it therefore makes you a more confident participant and more competent also, yes. That self-image is enhanced when you have a higher education and you are more confident when you're a participant, which makes you a better one, according to this opinions. Now, here's a reply. Anna says there's not necessarily a good thing to have increased self-image. It's often inflated and becomes pompous. That an enhanced self-image is not all that good an idea, because you can get an inflated self-image and become pompous, become arrogant. That's a good point. Yeah, that's both sides of the coin, of course. And we do try to do that. We always think about what is driving the participants. What's the driving factor behind their opinion, behind their stance, behind their side of the issue? It's not necessarily a good thing to have an enhanced self-image. Well, I think self-image is very important. Yes, and it might make you a more enthusiastic participant. I don't know if that makes you a better one. People are saying that does. That constitutes better. All right. And, Jason says that school learning, getting an extra degree, gives experience in dealing with research and theoretical concepts. That's an interesting point, that if you have a lot of school learning, that it gives experience in dealing with research, because, of course, when you go to school, you research topics, and theoretical concepts. Help you to think outside the box, somebody is saying. That's kind of an American idiom, and I know this is a global show, but theoretical concepts. Mackenzie says that theoretical does lead to practical with modifications. So you have to be able to, you have to be able to envision the goal, envision an outcome, which is, well, that's theoretical, isn't it? To envision something, to say, well, this is how it is now, but if we did this, it would change, it would alter, it would modify. That's a good point. The theoretical leads to practical with modifications. And, you know, Zamir and others are saying that also a formal education leads to a higher starting point for negotiations, a more educated starting point for negotiations. Yes. I've got some disagreement there because you can be an expert without a formal education, which would lead to a more educated starting point also. But, you know, it's a good point. You need to have a starting point for your negotiations. And if you're, especially if the participants are somewhat equal. We're getting some side discussion about that, that sometimes you get a group where there is a small percentage of people who are more experienced, more educated. They want to create a higher starting point for negotiations, as Zamir would say. And the other people and the other participants need to be, well, yeah, people are saying need to be educated. They need to be brought up to speed on the issues, on the research, on the opinions, on what it is that we're talking about. And that's where you have, well, I'm going to call them handouts, but they're not really handouts anymore, of course, because we all do this electronically now. And also, it's something that is not handed out at the time, right? We're going to do it ahead of time so we can all think on it. But it's an interesting point about a starting point and about the fact that you don't always have equal participants. Not equal in stature. People ask about equal in social stature. No, I don't mean it that way, although, well, yeah, globally, some people are asking about equality of social stature and about the differences between, like, stereotyping. In the United States, where I am, I, of course, like to think that there is no such thing, but everywhere there is. There's a certain a hierarchy sometimes that forms in groups, isn't there? And it is true, and this point is being made quite a bit, that, by Gabriella and others, that often the more educated participants are given greater respect and their opinions carry more weight. So Gabriella says, and others too, that often more educated participants are given greater respect and their opinions carry more weight. Yes, that's when the participants are not equal. And there does, sometimes you do have that. You've got kind of a funny hierarchy going where some people are naturally given more respect because they seem more experienced. And Devon says that if you have a better education and you're in an unequal situation, that the people who are given the more respect and their opinions carry more weight are often the more eloquent people because they have a better education and their speech patterns are more eloquent. Sybil says they have a fancier vocabulary. Yes, I suppose that's true, although quite frankly, that wears thin when people get up and make kind of an overblown presentation. But still, you know, and also some formal education may indeed give you more training on using computer tools, which does enhance a presentation. And you could bring a PowerPoint, you can do something that's more put together, and it's more impressive. And that would go towards, I suppose it would go towards more eloquent. Like Devon says, the more eloquent people have better education and therefore are respected more, given more weight. You know, Laura says that it's good to have participants with a higher education because they are more critical listeners and thinkers because they've experienced lecture note-taking. That's an interesting point. I didn't think about that, but maybe a point. That if you have a higher education, you are a more critical listener and thinker because you've experienced a lot of lectures and you've thought about a lot of issues outside of your personal knowledge. And we're going back to the theoretical. Yes, the point is being made that outside your personal knowledge is often theoretical. It might not be, though, but sometimes it is, and it's thinking about how to solve something. And it's really a problem-solving skill, isn't it? And Michael says that if you have a more formal education, your experience with turning in assignments on time, you've got more time management skills. Mm-hmm. And Dominic says that would make you more of a leader of the group. With your, you know, you've got time management skills, and you are a more eloquent speaker, perhaps. And a more critical listener and thinker because you've experienced lectures and note-taking. All very valid points. And thank you very much for all of your participation. And people are countering all those points. Thank you very much. And they're saying, well, that has to do with being an expert. And that has to do with your passion and your experience. And none of those things come from school learning, so to speak. Well, they could, I suppose, is the answer. People are making a very good point that these things could come from anything. They could come from experience. They could come from formal education. So these are traits that would make your opinion be more listened to. And, you know, Joanne is making an interesting point that if you have a more formal education, there's a good chance that you will have a more, what she is calling a white-collar job. That's kind of an American idiom. It means that you are in a more executive position, that you work with computers and with words and like that. And she said that you will have more experience with holding meetings and conferences because it's likely to have been your work experience. So we're really holding meetings, right? So you'd have more experience and have seen more and how that's done. You'd have more of an idea of the process. If you had a more formal education and you had a more executive position job. You know, Lynn in that vein also says that if you have a higher level employment, it trains you to assign duties and delegate tasks for effective management. That would make the group more effective, wouldn't it? If you were able to assign duties and delegate tasks so that everybody had a role to play and everybody understands it, and especially if the issues are complex. Because if you've got something fairly, everyone's kind of in agreement, they just don't know how to get to the goal, it's a real different thing than if the issues are hotly contested and they're complex. So that's when you need to be able to assign tasks and really have time management and meeting skills. This is true if you're going to be the host. And Carlin says that it's a skill set to be able to prioritize and break large tasks into smaller, more manageable series of goals. That you would have learned if you had been to a lot of conferences and meetings and done some schooling, you might have a skill set that would be able to prioritize and break large tasks into a smaller, more manageable series of goals. Very good point, Carlin. Thank you, all of you, for your participation. You know, and other people are saying it's a question of follow-through. Here's what Eve says. She says it's a question of follow-through with tedious tasks and assignments in order to reach a goal. And it's a parallel to getting an advanced degree. Now I can actually personally attest to that. Yes, that a lot of times there are kind of boring things to do, tedious tasks, as Eve puts it, that need to be done in order to move forward. We have to get some sort of a permit. We have to make connection with other people. We have to contact people. We have to get votes. I mean, there's some sort of a task that needs to be done in order to reach the goal, and that is parallel to getting an advanced degree. It's like doing papers and doing reading, and sometimes it's not so interesting, or it's kind of tedious, but you do it to go forward to get your degree, right? Your advanced degree, your diploma. And it's very similar when we are working towards a goal as a group. It's a similar idea to work towards something. Sometimes has some tasks that are not very glamorous but need to be done. And you know what? I think that this is a very good point. Galen is making a very good point, and it's very eloquently stated. He says that whether or not you have an advanced degree makes no difference. The key is to think in ways that create success. Whether or not you have an advanced degree makes no difference. The key is to think in ways that create success. Yes, to think in a goal-oriented, a focused manner so that we can see what needs to be done and we can see that we must get together to get there, and therefore we will use our experience, our education, and our passion to get us towards thinking in ways that create success, to get us to the goal of resolution, of negotiation, of compromise even. We need to have success and go forward. Good point. The key is to think in ways that create success. What a lovely way of putting it. Thank you very much. So, and that's really what Recipe for Peace Now does, right? We create an atmosphere, we create a meeting, we create a seminar, whatever it is that we're doing, that is convivial, because it allows you to think in ways that create success and not in adversarial ways. You see, the key is, of course, that you're going to need to get along for this one period of time, for these issues to be resolved. You've got to be able to have compromise on all sides. You've got to be able to have negotiation. And you need to be able to go forward to think in ways that create success. And it is true that Recipe for Peace Now, the recipe part, I suppose, is that in order to create the convivial atmosphere, we, of course, have some food in the room. And yes, I've said this before, and I know that a lot of you have been here before, and yes, you're going to do the labeling thing. Yes, I am, because it's very important to say at each show that if you create some food in the room, it makes a convivial atmosphere. The food is a tool. It is not because people are hungry. I mean, they might be, but it's not really to feed them dinner. It is to keep them in the room doing something pleasant. And I know that networking is a miserably overused phrase, but really it kind of is, isn't it? It's a way to get away from the formal setting and have a break, have a time out. Let people take 3 deep breaths and be able to come back refreshed and able to compromise, so that we can all reach a good outcome. So, the food is a tool, not an eating thing. It is a way to have a successful time out, a successful break, a successful atmosphere conducive to creating an agreement, to going forward, to setting our goals and achieving them. So, now that I've said this, I'm going to say what I say all the shows, which is all true. And some of you, yes, thank you. People are going, you're going to say label. Yes, I am. Before anybody brings any food or orders it or however it is you're getting it in, you need to take a survey. You need to ask the participants, email them, call them, however it is that you do it, if they are allergic to something, if they have a food prohibition, a dietary prohibition, or a religious prohibition about food. All very important things to know, and it needs to be communicated to everyone, so that everyone knows that not to bring something or that something is fine. And it needs to be accommodated because it's important. You want everyone to have a good time. And when you have people bring food, the food, even if it's catered, the food must be labeled, not with the name of what it is. I mean, that's pleasant and everything. You can add it on. But people need to know what is inside the dish. What's the ingredients? Just in case, because they need to be able to judge whether or not it violates a dietary restriction, an allergic restriction, or religious restriction. All very important. We need to ask, and we need to label. Also, it is, and I know that all of you, a lot of you have come back, thank you very much, that it is, I think it's the duty of the host to have some extra food on hand. And I think it's nice to have a safe recipe along with an adventure one. Now, what makes a recipe safe? Well, it is something that does not have a lot of ingredients, not a lot of hidden ingredients, something you can't see. And all of the ingredients, which are going to be, of course, labeled, are something that is familiar to the participants. Something that they will have eaten before, or they know that they can eat or not eat. Pardon me, I took a sip of water there. But anyway, a safe recipe is one that most people can eat. So, this time, our safe recipe is going to be a lovely, rather traditional beef casserole. Easy to make, not terribly expensive. Yes, substitute as you please. A lot of times people ask me about different kinds of proteins, different kinds of meats. I'm going to use ground beef because it is readily available to me and fairly inexpensive. If you like lamb or something, just substitute it. The key is to make sure it's cooked through. And if it's going to be something quite fatty, to skim the fat. Okay, here we go. We're going to have a tablespoon of oil, a pound of ground beef. I must confess that I like another half pound of ground pork if it is not against prohibitions. However, that makes it less of a safe recipe because people have religious restrictions about pork. So, if no pork, do it a pound and a half of ground beef. About 2 dozen of those little white onions. I must confess that in the States here, it is easy to get a frozen bag of those little white pearl onions. They're lovely, and you don't have to peel them. You don't have to mess with them. And yes, I definitely use the frozen pearl onions. Thaw them and make sure they're not icy cold in the middle. If you're going to use the actual onions and peel them, it's an extra step of work that I don't do just because it's so much easier. And quite frankly, pearl onions here where I am are hard to come by if they're not frozen. You don't see them very often in the produce department. 4 carrots. Thickly sliced, you know, of course, to scrape them. 4 celery sticks, also thickly sliced. About 1.5 cups of all-purpose flour. And a scant 2¾ cups of beef stock. You can always add a little bit more. I think I like it to be not very it's not really watery, but not very wet. So I think about 2 3/4 cups is what I put in. It'll simmer off, so you can judge it. But I like it to be thicker. Okay. So we're going to preheat the oven to 350. And now we're going to heat the oil in a casserole pot that you can put in the oven, like a flame-proof casserole. And we're going to add the beef, and we're going to cook it and stir it up so that it's nice and brown and sealed all around the ground meat. If you've got a fairly fatty type of ground beef, you don't need to use the butter. I just like to use it just because it coats the pan. Now, we're going to add the onions, and we're going to cook them until they are cooked through, especially if we're using the frozen ones. They're not hard. They're not cold in the middle. We're going to stir in the carrots and the celery and the flour, and we're going to cook that all together, stirring real constantly. We're just going to keep stirring that because we want the flour to mix in so that it mixes, thickens. So we've got everything together now, except really the stock, right, the liquid. We've got the meat that we browned first so that it was all cooked through, the onions that we also made sure they were hot and cooked through, and they will get a little bit softer like that too, and the carrots and the celery and the flour that we stirred constantly. It takes maybe 2 minutes. You don't have to stir it forever. It all incorporates in real nice. It's just that you don't want it to be clumps of flour. You want it to be all incorporated is the idea. Now, we've got all that in our nice casserole pot. We're now going to gradually stir in the beef stock. Just kind of gradually so that it doesn't lump up. Stir it all around. And we're going to bring the whole thing to a boil to get it all incorporated and to make everything hot. It's now gone to a boil. We're going to cover the pot with a nice tight lid, and we're going to put in the oven for about an hour and a half. Yum! There it is. It's simple. It's a one-pot recipe, which, you know, is very nice. Then, if you're going to the potluck, you take your pot with you. It's all done. It's all there. It's finished. Yes, people are asking if you can prep it and then cook it when you get there. I'm quite in favor of cooking on the premises where you are having the negotiation, the meeting, because I think it makes it smell lovely. This cooks for kind of a long time and needs some stirring. So I'm going to say not my favorite, because those of you who have been here before, and of course the shows are archived at the radio station, blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow, and also the last five on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. And sometimes we talk about, in fact, frequently we talk about recipes where you can make them together as a group, because you can prep some vegetables and things first, and then I like to do a group recipe where everybody's participating on something that takes very little time, because this takes, well, it takes a while to get it to boil and cover it and put it in the oven for about an hour and a half, hour and a quarter. That's kind of a long time to wait. I would say cook it, bring it, and reheat it. It will smell lovely. You need it to be hot. And also, people are asking what you serve it over. And, of course, this is something that you serve. Pasta is very, very lovely. Rice. I must confess that my favorite is mashed potatoes, because I think that the beef casserole with the onions is just, and the vegetables, the carrots and the celery, is just lovely over mashed potatoes, and it doesn't have potatoes in it. And also, those of you, some of you have actually seen me do this and seen the table that I set, so to speak, and yes, I do think that the casserole goes separate because it's in the casserole pot anyway, and that the bottom part, the starch, goes in a big separate container, a big separate pot also, so that people can take as much as they want. Mm-hmm. Pasta, tube pasta type, or bow tie, and or rice, or people are saying couscous, yes, of course, and whatever it is that you like to put under a stew, essentially speaking, because we're calling it a casserole, but it's, you know, yeah, people are saying a stew does not have ground beef. All right, we'll call it a casserole still, but it some sort of a starch, whatever you like. I personally like mashed potatoes. That's just me. I think it's particularly yummy. And when I make this, I bring the big pot of mashed potatoes also. Good. So that was our safe recipe. Why was it safe? Because the ingredients are familiar. Because you can basically see all of the ingredients when you look at it. And generally speaking, people are not allergic, have a dietary prohibition or religious prohibition. And if you think you might have anybody with a, especially religious prohibition, then you shouldn't put pork in it. I just do it because I think it gives it an extra level of flavor. And ground pork is indeed, this is true, fairly easy for me to come by. But you can choose whether or not to do so, depending on your people. So, we're now going to have our adventure recipe. Now, what makes this an adventure recipe? It's not a very complicated one, but it's got fish in it. And fish is something that people oftentimes cannot eat. There's a lot of allergies to fish. And when you look at this in its finished state, and I know this seems kind of silly, but when you look at it, it's not that obvious that it has fish. It could be tomatoes. You know what I mean? We're using salmon, which is red, pink. It could be a vegetable. And therefore, it's very important to label that this is fish. Because people truly have a nasty allergy to that. And so here we go, but this is our adventure recipe. And it's a pasta and salmon frittata. It also has a lot of egg in it. And there are dietary and allergy prohibitions against eggs, too. That's why we label everything extremely carefully. Here we go. This does, however, make a lovely dish if you can serve it, or even if somebody can see the labeling and not eat it, because it's very pretty and it will hold its shape very well. So we're going to have 6 ounces of spaghetti that we're going to cook al dente and drain. A package, like an 11-ounce package of frozen lima beans. They're sometimes called fava beans. They're the flat green type. Pardon me, they were called lima beans in my youth, and now they seem to call them fava beans. But quite frankly, they come frozen where I am. If you do not use the frozen ones, you know that you need to cook them, of course, and soak them and like that because they're hard beans. But I'm going to say use the frozen ones that we are going to thaw because it's cheaper and easier in where I am. And if it is not where you are, you want to use fresh, hey, your recipe will probably come out nicer than mine. Remember to drain them. About 1 ounce of butter. A nice big onion sliced real thin. I personally use a mandolin for it, one of those up and back to slice it. And I know the purists are going to be mad at me, but I'm going to use a big can of salmon. It's about a 15-ounce can. I like the red. You can use pink that we're going to drain. Now, theoretically, you can eat the skin and the bones in canned salmon. It's been cooked already. It's in oil and stuff, which is why we want to drain it really well. Personally speaking, I not only drain it, but I actually pat it down with a paper towel to get any of the excess, we're going to call it juice, but you know what I mean, any of the excess oil out. Canned salmon comes with bones and with skin in the can. Can you eat them? Yes. Do I think you should? No. Take out the big bones and kind of flake the whole thing, kind of give it a nice flake, a nice pull apart, and take out the bones, for heaven's sakes. I don't care who says that you can eat them. People are saying you can eat them, it's wasteful not to. I know, but it looks icky. And, well, all right, I've got a lot of votes for mash the bones and put them back in. Why? Because people are saying it gives a better consistency. All right, do as you please. You know, there are no rules with Recipe for Peace. Now these recipes are just suggestions. You can modify them. I take the bones, especially the spine bone one, the vertebra, and I throw them out. I honestly do. And I must confess that even though it too is edible, I also take off the big pieces of skin that are rolled around in the tinned salmon, and I throw those out too. Why? Not because they are a bad consistency, excuse me, but because I think they're visually unappealing in the dish. Okay, now that we've talked about salmon. But yes, I say bone out, skin out. Do as you please, but you need to flake the salmon. So that it goes into pieces in the dish. Okay, so we've got our spaghetti, which is cooked al dente. We've got our frozen lima beans. We've got a pat of butter, nice big pat of butter, a nice onion thinly sliced, and about a 15-ounce can of salmon that we're going to drain really well, take the bones out and off the skin, the big pieces of skin. We also need 6 eggs that we're going to beat lightly, 5 ounces of whipping cream. Yes, do not cheap out. You must use the thick stuff. And 3/4 of a cup of whole milk. So, we've already cooked the pasta, right? We're going to take the lima beans that are frozen, that we've thawed, and I'm going to put them in a bowl and cover it with boiling water, the beans, cover them in the bowl with boiling water for about 10 minutes. Why have I done this? Yes, yes. A lot of you know this trick. It's because I'm going to, after the 10 minutes are up, I'm going to drain out all the water real carefully, and I'm going to shell the beans, take the shells off that membrane on the outside that gets loose in your recipe and looks ugly and doesn't taste all that good. I'm going to shell them. I'm going to take off the membrane, so I've just got the bean part. And I'm going to throw out it's like a skin on it. I'm going to throw out the skins. There's no sense of saving them. They're garbage. So we have soaked the beans to get the skins off. 10 minutes boiling water to cover the beans will do it. It's a really nice trick. Yes, people are saying you can also, after you drain them, you can run them under a faucet, run them under water. I don't usually, I just flick it between my fingers. But yes, the idea is to take the outer skin off. So we've got our cooked pasta, we've got our skinned beans. We're now going to melt the butter in a nice pan, and we're going to add the onions, and we're going to cook it over a nice medium heat until it's nice and translucent. Then we're going to mix the cooked pasta, the skinned beans, the onion, which is still in the pot, the salmon, the egg, the cream, and the milk in a bowl. See, we don't want to add the eggs to the pot because we'll get scrambled eggs right away. We're mixing all of these things in a nice bowl. Well, the pasta's probably cold by now, too, all the cold things. And we're going to add the onion after we get the other ingredients mixed so that it kind of doesn't hit real hard, real hot. Okay, everything's mixed together right in this bowl, not in the pot pan. Now we're going to grease an oven-proof pan. I like to use a round one, because I like to make pie wedges out of when it's finished. If you want to make squares, that's your business. You can use a rectangular one. About a 10-inch round pan is what I like to use. And we're going to pour the entire mixture into it. We've greased it already. the trick is that this pan needs to have a lid because we have to cover it and cook it over low heat until it sets. It's pretty firm. Now, we're going to do something we don't always do. We're going to fire up the broiler. And we're going to put the, once it's set on the stove, it's pretty much cooked through, we're going to take the frittata and put it under the broiler, right on the top, until it's really set. It takes about 5 minutes. If you don't do that step, when you go to serve, if you don't put it under the grill, it'll taste fine, but it won't have the firmness of the frittata. It really needs to go underneath the grill for the 5 minutes. I have indeed in my day not done that because I've gotten rushed and it's really not a good idea. Also, so now we're done. We've mixed everything together. We've cooked it on the stove, covered, and now we're putting it under the grill to set the top, to set the whole thing, to make it firm. Also, when you take it out of the stove, out of the oven, let it stand for about 5 minutes. It will firm up the insides, which will be good for cutting and good for aesthetics, too. It'll look prettier. So, there we have it. Yeah, I do. I always say to leave things out for a few minutes. I think they set better when you go to take them out because this really doesn't have a crust in the sense of a pie crust like a quiche does. So, there we have it. It is the adventure recipe because it has salmon and a lot of eggs because it's a frittata, right? It's got the pasta and the eggs and the onions and the salmon. And it's just delicious. If you serve it in a round container, you can make little wedges out of it. Do set it aside for about 5-10 minutes after it's out of the oven. And our time, and so that there you have it. And yes, people are asking about different substitutions. Yes, substitute whatever you like, but whatever it is needs to be not adding a lot of liquid. The more liquid you add to this, the less firm the frittata will be, and it looks so much better. It'll taste delicious, but it looks so much better. So there you have it. That's our adventure recipe, primarily because it has a lot of eggs and fish, and those are two things that people have prohibitions about. So I see that our time together is nearly up. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming back. If you would like to contact us, we are at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. If you'd like to visit the website, it is recipeforpeacenow.com. The most recent five episodes are archived on the website, and all of the episodes, all the shows, including the last five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thank you very much for coming. I always learn something during these shows, and I hope you do too, and I hope you come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.